I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Thanks for joining us for a special Thanksgiving edition of Newsworks Tonight. As Philadelphia-area residents gather to give thanks and enjoy their holiday meal, we too are focusing on gratitude and food. Ahead this evening, an appeal to appreciate your neighbors because, as they say, you can't divorce them. So, which ingredient really says Thanksgiving to you? Newsworks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas asked a few Philadelphia chefs that question. First up, Marcy Turney chooses a long-neglected vegetable that's been enjoying a revival of sorts.
It was late one night by the pale moonlight. All the vegetables gave a spree.
When Thanksgiving is coming, I get excited about the sides, and especially vegetables, and how to do them in different ways.
So if you had to pick one vegetable that really spoke Thanksgiving to you, what would it be?
The vegetable I would choose would be a parsnip. When you roast it or cook it down in some cream and aromatics and puree it, it's awesome. It can be sweet as well as savory, so that's always a favorite thing of mine if I can find that in a vegetable.
Parsnips have made a comeback. I feel like they're really popular now, so when you come up with recipes, are you doing something really new, you think, or do you feel like there's a heritage there that you're drawing from?
I just love different cuisines, and an example, camotes are sweet potatoes, and in Mexican cuisine, they will serve them with a little bit of honey simply on them. But for parsnips, I would roast them or smoke them and roast them, and then do a little chipotle, honey, thyme glaze on them.
That's Chef Marcy Turney, parsing parsnips with Newsworks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas. With her partner, Valerie Safran, Turney runs a group of restaurants that includes Barbuzo, Haminera, and Lolita. We move next from Marcy Turney's modern kitchens back in time to kitchens in colonial America. Cliveden in Philadelphia's Germantown neighborhood is hosting a series of talks looking at kitchens as measures of social change in different periods of history. WHYY's Peter Crimmon spoke with historian Kelly Dietz about her recent talk in the series on Cooking for the Big House, Slavery, Race, Gender, and the Kitchen Axis.
A lot of the research you did was based on letters that the woman of the house, the mistress, would send to other her friends, other women of other houses. Did you get a sense of the head of household's relationship with their slave in the kitchen through those letters?
Absolutely. You have, you know, complaints of the enslaved cooks being sick and having to cancel dinners. You also have references of being very excited about a certain meal coming up. And this is all very much related to courting and marrying off your children, right? So using food as a commodity.
So they would throw dinners when they wanted to present their daughter to a possible suitor?
Absolutely.
So this is a very important dinner, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You can't serve, you know, saltine crackers and, you know, cheese whiz. You got to bring the head cheese out, and you have to have the oyster stew, and you have to have the puddings and the brandy wines and all of it. And who was making all of this? It was the enslaved cooks who were doing this.
These southern plantations were famous for their hospitality. It's sort of amazing to think that so much of the household is riding on the slave in the kitchen making food that can be served to your guests.
Absolutely, and that's what my research has uncovered, is the currency that these enslaved cooks had and their skills. They were allowed to live with their immediate family, and they were allowed to eat certain things that the field hands couldn't typically eat. You know, the flip side of that, of course, is that they were enslaved, you know, abused. I mean, this didn't stop, but they were able to use their skills to have a certain kind of lifestyle.
They could sort of leverage their,
absolutely.
If they proved themselves as a good cook, they could leverage that to be treated slightly better?
Yes, because there were, and also the white folks were afraid of being poisoned. The back of these recipe books, it's all medicine. And the difference between medicine and poison is dosage. And, you know, this is before hypodermic needles. The way you poison somebody in the 19th century and in the 18th century is through food. And so there was a very complicated relationship between these white folks and the person cooking their food.
You wrote in an article that the slaves had access to poison,
yes.
Had access, they had food, and they had trust, which is a perfect recipe for murder. Did you find that anyone enacted that recipe?
Yeah, there's. I mean, if you look at the court records, there are several cases of enslaved cooks being tried and hanged for poisoning. There's also a lot of cases, too, where they got off. That's very curious to me. it's a very complicated relationship, but there was a case at North Bend Plantation in Charles City County where this man named Billy, he was an enslaved man, and he poisoned his master not once but twice. And I don't know what happened to him. It's a burned county, so the records are gone. But there are records talking about the owner of this plantation getting poisoned two times by this man named Billy. So, it, you know, it opens up a lot of questions.
Historian Kelly Dietz spoke with WHYY's Peter Crimmins. The saying goes, you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your family. And for the most part, you can't choose your neighbors either. On this day, when we celebrate with family and friends, writer Andy Hockman says the effort to befriend or at least to know your neighbors can add richness to life.
We knew the neighbors had become true friends when they helped us say goodbye to the old refrigerator. Here's the story. My mother hates change. Her living room has had the same red carpet for 50 years. She kept her platform shoes until they cycled back into style. And when the built-in refrigerator finally sputtered to a stop, we held a ritual to mark its passing. The family across the street had been over for dinner once or twice, and my partner and I happily joined the group. We zipped the kids into footed pajamas so they could watch South Pacific on my parents' VCR while we ate dessert. They were just the latest in a long skein of neighbors who laced themselves into our lives. In 1965, the block was crammed with kids. The boy who dared me to touch my eyeball, the sisters who taught me Chinese jump rope. It was the neighbors whose couch I slept on the night my mother and I came home to find the TV by the front door and strange voices upstairs. And this year, when my father spent 9 weeks in the ICU, neighbors bundled my mother's mail, shoveled her walk, and drove to the hospital with homemade cake. Apparently, all this neighborliness is more the exception than the rule. According to the 2014 General Social Survey, only about 20% of Americans routinely spend time with the people living next door, and a third say they've never interacted with their neighbors. More and more, we conduct our lives at arm's length. I text my best friend, even though she lives three blocks away. I chat with my aunt, Bluetooth plugged into my ear, while driving to get the kids from school. Neighbors, on the other hand, are in your face, or at least across the walkway, driving you insane with that leaf blower or offering you the last of the green tomatoes. Depending on how snugly you're situated, a strange intimacy can flower. You smell the neighbor's curry every time you pass apartment 4G. They hear your argument through the open kitchen window. Proximity doesn't always breed affection, but sometimes, against all odds, it does. You start to care about Miss Dottie, who carpets her patio each spring in new wall-to-wall astroturf. You bring some jam to the guys across the street, the ones with the tiki room tricked out in 1960s kitsch. One day, you find yourself bonding with the ladies two doors down, even though they are African-American Seventh-Day Adventists and you are white Jewish lesbians, over the troublesome neighbors in between, the ones with out-of-control bamboo and shifty eyes. Not every neighbor is destined to be your friend. I've lived next door to a crack house in Portland, Oregon, and a bunch of 20-something squatters right here in beautiful Mount Airy. My in-laws were plagued for years by a tyrannical neighbor who policed the laundry room schedule and blasted rodeo music late at night. But most people aren't like that. Most people are no stranger than you are. Yes, you, with your habit of greeting the UPS guy in your ratty college bathrobe or belting songs from Pippin while you wash the car. If you believe, and I do, that reconciliation is within reach between whites and blacks in South Africa, between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland, even between Israelis and Palestinians in the bloodied Middle East, then how can you not make an effort to coexist amenably with the people on your block? So start small. Tap on the neighbor's door. Borrow a cup of sugar. Bring back a plate of cookies. Share the lawnmower, because who really needs her very own? Then take a few giant steps back, enough to remember that we're all neighbors on this dizzied, fragile knob of earth. In the end, of course, our farewell ritual wasn't really about the refrigerator. It was about change, resisting it, yielding to it, marking it. We stood in a semicircle, and I thought about all the neighbors who had shared food from that fridge or eaten at our table. the people we didn't plan to love, the ones who are just a slender wall away, passing in and out of this brief, sweet life. I'm Andy Hochman.
Andy Hochman is a writer who lives in Philadelphia. You're listening to a special Thanksgiving edition of Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Our next chef's favorite Thanksgiving ingredient is one that was an early American staple, but almost died out here. Happily, it's back on farms in New Jersey and Lancaster County. Here's Chef Andrew Wood of the Center City restaurant Russet with his quintessential Thanksgiving ingredient.
Chestnuts, definitely chestnuts. We do a lot with local chestnuts here. We got a bunch of chestnuts from New Jersey and a bunch of chestnuts from Lancaster County. Chestnuts used to be an American standard, and then they were wiped out by a huge blight. First one was, well, two blights actually. One was in the 30s and the other was in the 50s. And they've been mostly replaced with Asian breeds that are blight resistant. They're tasty, and I think about them. I like chestnut soup, especially if we're going to do foie gras, which we don't do much here, but I would break it out for that. Yeah, and then paired with meats, I think they're delicious. And I dry them. I make flour, and we do stuffing and all kinds of stuff like that. Make bread, chestnut bread, put it inside our roasted birds. And my wife does a chestnut cake that's pretty amazing. It's kind of like the Molten Center chocolate cake, but it's chestnut. And it's like a kind of this oozy chestnut filling that comes out when you cut into it. It's pretty spectacular.
That's Chef Andrew Wood from the Center City restaurant, Russet. Coming up on Newsworks Tonight, another area chef says his Thanksgiving wouldn't be complete without a particular local crop, and then we'll visit one of the growers in the midst of a very busy work week. Welcome back to our special Thanksgiving edition of Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Even before this holiday is over, many Americans are already moving on to the next. And aside from Black Friday enticements, a Thanksgiving tradition for many is decorating for Christmas. In South Philadelphia, that means filling front windows with a scene of holiday cheer. For many, including Newsworks web producer Marilyn D'Angelo, that tradition starts at Kindy's, the Christmas light factory and superstore. WHYY's Katie Culinary tagged along with Marilyn to Kindy's and offers this audio postcard.
Sitting in the shadow of Philadelphia's sports arenas and an oil refinery, Marilyn D'Angelo's house sticks out among the row homes on Packer Avenue. That's because her front window is empty.
See, so everybody's got the three-panel windows, basically.
As we drive down the street, Marilyn points out bay windows strung with icicle lights and filled with tinsel snowmen, animatronic Santas, and cotton ball snow. It's a South Philly tradition she remembers from her childhood when her grandparents lived on this block.
It's not quite a competition. It's just that everyone does it their own way, and it's a nice mix. Some of the houses get a little crazy. So this is Kindy's. Yay. Ooh.
We pull up to a giant brick factory where Marilyn's grandmother, her nonna, worked in the 70s sewing military uniforms. This is where you go to get your window dressing in South Philly. Feeling a bit overwhelmed, I let Marilyn take the lead.
I guess we could get a cart. I'm kind of scared. I don't know what the lines are like in here because carts make it a little hard to maneuver when it's really packed. It's really, like, literally a warehouse. So we're just walking through this big plastic sheets like we're walking into a cooler, but it's not. It's a Christmas store. Cool. These would be pretty in a window. What is that? These could be something. Gold tinsel trees. I think it was the third wise man that brought the sparkle tinsel tree. The other two, they brought the leopard candles. Oh, giraffe candles. See, if you want a flameless giraffe candle Christmas, you can get it here. You can get anything here. Like, look at this. Oh, look at this. Now this is a nativity. Look at that. You have all the little houses and the little people. And, you know, my nonna would set up a sideboard and it would just be a little world. And as a kid, you would go and you'd look at the little figurines and see who lived in the little houses. And this is pretty impressive. I mean, they have a carnival in this town. So we have bows, we have a jingly thing. We have our tree topper, and I still have nothing for my window.
Ho, ho, ho.
Santa!
Now what are we taping here for?
I'm decorating my window, and she came along for the ride.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Enjoy decorating your window.
I will. Thank you.
I'll come and take a look at it.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas.
Ooh, Christmas packages.
Yeah, that's it. 23-inch electric tinsel snowman in box. Oh, is there a snowman in that box? Eh, I don't like it as much. I think we're going to go with the 3 tinsel tree. Like the trio, 1, 2, 3, little lights. Maybe some fake snow on the bottom. Yeah, all right, let's do that. All right, let's hope this cart works because I'm stealing it. Sorry, Santa. I gotta go.
The total comes to $113.54. As we leave the store, we notice the Kindy's motto painted on the wall. Stack 'em deeper, sell 'em cheaper. Back on Packer Avenue later that afternoon, we stand on the sidewalk to take in Marilyn's work.
All right, moment of truth. We have 3 tinsel trees, a little bit of snow, some icicle lights, and some gold leaf leaves covered in glitter. It's classic. I'm happy. Now my wreath doesn't match, though. Maybe I have to go back to Kindy's.
It's a marshmallow world in the winter. When the snow comes, the cover.
To see photos of Marilyn's and other holiday windows of South Philadelphia, check out newsworks.org. So when do you put up Christmas decorations? We asked our audience, when is it socially acceptable to decorate your home for the holidays? The response, a resounding, after Thanksgiving. That's according to 85% of the respondents, so get to it. Now's your chance. You can add your opinion via Twitter or on the NewsWorks Facebook page. Now back to the holiday at hand. As we continue down our list of Thanksgiving essentials, there's one ingredient that's been truly transformed since the days when it slid out of a can. Chef Damon Menapace of Kensington Quarters is here to talk about his favorite Thanksgiving ingredient with NewsWorks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas.
Cranberries. I think they pair really nicely with all the holiday, all the Thanksgiving favorites. They bring that tart aspect to the dish. They kind of cleanse the palate, and they can be a lot of fun. You can use them in a lot of different ways.
Beyond the jelly, it's kind of matured a little bit from the can-shaped thing. People do a little bit higher quality relish, but there's a lot more you can do with cranberries.
Absolutely. I do like to make a nice cranberry relish. I prefer to keep them a little more whole as opposed to the jelly. Of course, desserts, they go great in like a little bit in an apple pie. I've done a pear and cranberry strudel. Of course, you can make like a nice cranberry sorbet. But they also fit well in other savory applications, like, for instance, maybe a green bean salad with some cranberries in it, or a little bit of cranberries in the stuffing. Brings that nice tartness to like the cold day. It's all about balance. You have all that rich meat or the rich sides, the fall root vegetables, and the cranberries bring that tartness back, that kind of excitement to the plate. Of course, they're like an awesome local food. Most of the cranberries in the U.S. come out of New Jersey. Again, one of my holiday favorites, absolutely.
Damon Menapace, executive chef at Kensington Quarters, rounding out our troika of essential Thanksgiving ingredients from area chefs. As Damon just mentioned, cranberries are a major crop in our region, especially in New Jersey's Pine Barrens, and that's where we're heading next. Thanksgiving week is a holiday for many. For others, it's the busiest time of the year, and that's the case for our guest on today's recap. If she wasn't working flat out this week, many Thanksgiving tables would be missing a key ingredient. It's that favorite that Chef Damon Menapace just named.
This past week, we call it Cranberry Crazy. My name is Mary Ann Thompson, and I'm the manager for Birch's Cranberry, which is over 100-year-old family farm in Tabernacle Township, New Jersey. People bring us orders, and we rush, and we get all the cranberries sorted, and we make sure they get to them. At the moment, we're on standby doing orders and trying to get all the cranberries ready to get in the stores in case they run out. This is my father's farm. He got it from his relatives over 100 years ago. We're at the headwaters of the Badstow River, which is in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey, which is a national reserve. In the old days, we would use a scoop hand scoop them, and people would come from all over and stay here during the season. Later on, they went to water picking. A water picker is sort of a tractor with a lot of reels on it, and it knocks the berries off. They float to the top, and we corral them like a cowboy, and then we take them out of the bog with a conveyor. On this farm, a lot of the berries are heirloom berries that have been here, you know, for generations. Some were made and developed at the Rutgers lab over the years, and some are just wild berries that people cut and then planted in the box. Right after February, usually we get some time off, and maybe a little bit of April. But there's always something to do, as any farmer knows. It is an endless amount of new projects, new ideas.
That's farmer Mary Ann Thompson of Birch's Cranberry in Tabernacle, New Jersey. You can hear about the work week of others in the Philadelphia area at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. We hope you enjoyed our special Thanksgiving edition of Newsworks Tonight, produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Download a podcast of this and other episodes of the show at newsworks.org. A Philadelphia-based African dance and drum ensemble celebrates the holiday weekend with performances of works newly commissioned by a choreographer from Senegal. We'll meet members of Kulu Mele on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. And from all of us at Newsworks Tonight and WHYY, have a happy and healthy Thanksgiving holiday weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.